Today is part two of my interview with Katie Gardner, you know, talking about secret stories. So if you haven't listened to last episode, that's 178, you might want to go there first. And now it's time for more secret stories and superhero vows and the way kids learn. Enjoy.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
During a presentation, I heard you talk about the superhero vowels, and I was hoping you'd specifically get into mommy E and sneaky Y, but can you explain what your topic of the superhero vowels is all about?
And that's a really good example to use, because while, and I'm going to give an example of something that's more on a surface level first, and then go into that deeper piece. One of the biggest focuses of Imordino Yang's work, and also Judy Willis, who mirrors a lot of the same focal points. It's the social, emotional, affective learning domain that we want to really tap into. In other words, if we're looking for a common denominator of what all kids kind of come in with, it's already developed. The brain develops back to front. The mid-rear part of the brain is going to be that social, emotional, affective area. It's the part of the brain that, you know, makes our subs go nuts when they come to our classroom because the kids are saying, he can't be the line leader and she's not allowed to go be a runner with her and teacher doesn't let them sit together. You know, all the stuff they can keep track of so perfectly and yet they can't figure out what page they're supposed to be on and reading.
Yes.
If you're a parent and you say, what did you do today? You know, they can't tell you what they did in science, but boy, they can tell you who got in trouble and what the punishment was and what the principal said. So those social emotional connections are an area that functions at an expertise level. And a lot of the research to spark a need to know, again, in kids who maybe don't have a background knowledge of what they need to know because they don't know what's off, because they don't know what things are supposed to do, is to tap into the social emotional domain. So most of what the secret stories are, and the secret stories, it's not a program, it's really a teacher toolkit to put meaning where there otherwise wouldn't be, so that kids have an internal compass to make decisions about words they've never laid eyes on before. And it allows the teachers to teach the reader, not the reading. You don't want to teach 200 sight words so that they can read at a level G by the end of the year. You know, you want to teach them, you want to give them the tools they need to pick up anything, to write about anything. And that is a completely different animal than when you're, you know, kind of memorizing your way through becoming an actor with a script instead of an actual reader who can pick up and use text. So all of this to say, one example that kind of sets the baseline for a secret story, and I'm going to share this first because it doesn't have those same dimensions as the ones you mentioned, which are actually the ones that are going to lead us into the neatest place. But an easy example of tossing out a secret, since this is not a program. There's no scope or sequence. Things come up when they come up. So if you're in a classroom and it's the first day of school and you're doing the alphabet, let's say you're kinder or you're first grade, and you're doing the alphabet and you've just finished singing your little song and you said, you know, A is supposed to say at or A when you sang your song. And then you proceed after you've sung, you know, A says apple, at, and A can say A. You walk to your calendar and you point to the word August. And there's that big letter that looks just like it did over there, capital A. And now you're telling this word's August. Now, if anybody's actually paying attention to you, which they may not be because they're probably licking their shoe if it's kindergarten, but if they are paying attention to you, they're going to think, wait a minute, what the heck? Were you just playing with us when you were telling us it was supposed to do? Because I don't remember what you said it did over there, but I know it wasn't that. And if I remember, wasn't there another letter up there that you said ah? I think it was that O, that circle thing. Wasn't that the one that said, now I don't see it in this word. How can you point to the exact same letter in the same 3-minute period and give it an entirely different sound, no less one that belongs to another letter? And we do this all day long. So a secret gives you the ability to let them know why this isn't doing what it should. See, they didn't know that there were two letters that are in love in this word August. They just didn't know that. There are two letters that have a huge crush on each other. And they're A and U. And just like, not just A and U. A and U have a huge crush on each other, but A and W do too. Now, they're not in this word. Now, I would show a picture of these little hearts with A, U, and A, W, and they've got their little sweetheart chief. And I tell him, you know, anytime these letters have to stand like right up against each other in a word, they just get so embarrassed that they always put their heads down and say, no, you know, that body gesture, that vocal expression, that's part of that need to know. You're going to get kids' attention that so far haven't been interested because they don't know an A from a monkey from the letter three. But they just heard you say magic words like secret, and now you're doing something weird. So they're focusing, they're listening. Now, that's a way to set a tone that if things don't do what they should, there's a reason for it. It gives kids just a taste of understanding that there's more than meets the eye, and you're not just not a walking contradiction. You know, so basically the best time to tell secrets when you feel like a big fat liar. When you seem like you're contradicting yourself every time you turn around, probably time to tell a secret. Now, that's a kind of cut and dry secret. Two letters come together, that's the sound they make. Just like, you know, in the classroom, if two kids come together, they're probably gonna fight. That's why they're not allowed to sit together. Kids can keep track of those kinds of things because they're set in an area of the brain that's easy to work with and maneuver. Now, Mommy E and Sneaky Y, very similar. And I'm gonna use, Sneaky Y example first. Sneaky Y, we probably look like the biggest liars of all when we deal with the Y. Because, you know, we no sooner say Y says yo, yo, yuff, yuff, yuff in our alphabet. Then we again walk to our darn calendar, which is the root of all evil pretty much when it comes to looking like a liar, because they see that letter Y everywhere on that calendar. And the only thing it isn't doing is saying yuff. January E, E, Sun, Sunday, July, everything it can do, seemingly it does do, except the one thing that we tell kids to expect it to do in that calendar. And then you add to that, you know, the boys' bathroom, or that this big book is by this author. We are constantly unreinforcing what our assessment's going to require kids to know at those earliest grade levels, which is why it says yeah, because the other sounds of Y don't come into play until second grade. Because ironically, we chop the coda into three pieces, and four if you add pre-K to the mix, and we divvy it out in bits across grade levels. So if you think about it, you know, you need access to the whole code to do much of anything with it, and you're not going to get it for at least 3 to 4 years. Dick Allington says, and it's just such a low-key line, but it's so true. He just said, you know, 3 to 4 years is an awful long time to wait for access to the whole code. And it really is. If you're going to be reading and writing about your pet mouse on day one, you're going to have a tough time doing it if all you have is a B, a K, and an R. How can one do that? And yet that's the commonplace if you're doing letter week in kinder. So Sneaky Y just gives you an easy way to, in kinder, teach a second grade skill. And it's as simple as just letting kids know that, you know what, Y, he got sick and tired of saying yeah. And thinking about this, it might have been helpful for you to know about the vowels, because then you'll know why he wants to be one so badly. But he got sick and tired of saying yeah. He didn't like his sound. He was sick of it. He was tired of making it. So he decided one day he was going to be sneaky. And he heard about these superhero vowels, which are these letters in the alphabet that have a power that no other letter has. They can say their name, which is huge in like the mind of a letter. Because, you know, every other letter just gets stuck going buh, 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 or kuh, kuh, kuh all the time. So these vowels are just everybody's heroes. So he decided he was going to be sneaky, and he snuck into the closets of Superhero E and Superhero I. And he took one of each of their capes, which is where their powers lie. So now, whenever he's at the end of a word and he doesn't think anybody can see him, he'll always be wearing either his E or his I cape, so he can use their superpowers to make their sound. Like Mom E, Candy, Sky, July. But when he's at the beginning of a word and he knows all eyes are on him, he's going to do what any good line leader would. He's going to just stand there and behave and go, yeah, yeah, yellow, yes, you, yak, yeah, yeah. It's only when he's at the end and he knows no one's likely to see him that he's going to be sneaky and he's going to be wearing his E or his I cape. Now, that mirrors kids' behavior, because kids also know when to be sneaky and when not to be sneaky. If they're going to smack Susie over the head, they're not going to do it when they're the line leader. They're going to wait until they're the caboose, because that's the best place to get away with doing things you're not supposed to do. So it's a positional wise skill, and yet it can be rendered into something that is what any kid off the street in a class could tell you, even in pre-K, which is, I'm going to do this at the end, but I would never do it at the beginning. So what it, and I didn't tell you about, because you might be wondering, well, what about the words like they or play or today? That's not Sneaky Y. That's actually E-Y, A-Y, and they are like Fonzie, which if anyone is under 40, they may not know who they are, but E-Y and A-Y are just too cool. So anytime they get together, they always stick up their thumbs and go, eh, and that's the sound that they make. But that's not Sneaky Y, that's E-Y, A-Y. So anyway, now kids are armed with these things that the letter Y can do. So when they see a word, They don't have to have seen that word before to roll up their sleeves, come up with the best betting odds for Las Vegas about what to try for that Y sound. And that's really the key, is to equip kids from the earliest grade levels by using what they already understand and know, you know, using their framework of understanding, that social and emotional framework of understanding. I can get away with this when I'm here, but when I'm over there, there's no way you're going to catch me doing that. You know, having that compass to give them the best betting odds on how to attack a word. What's that why most likely to say based on what I know I do? And that's golden, because that means you can crack hundreds of words, not just the four sight words that you learn. Because you know what you get for the work that you put into learning four sight words? Four sight words. But if you have a tool, you can crack hundreds of sight words. And there's fun in that, because that's what triggers the need to know. You know, you're arming them with what they need as a reader to read what they want to read, not just read the four words you gave them and hope they read them enough that they stick, even knowing that some kids won't read them enough because they're not going to do their homework at home, or they're not going to have a book at home to keep, you know, recycling or revisiting those same four and then eight and then 20 and then 100 sight words. And that's where the beauty kind of becomes. There's a brain-based quote that says miracles are common and consistent when you teach with the brain in mind. It can look like a miracle when a little five-year-old approaches a word and attacks it with what is supposed to be a second grade skill, but it's not when you see where they're coming from. Then it's perfectly logical. Substitutes are not impressed when little Johnny says, he can't stand there because if he's at the end of the line, he'll spit on everybody. He has to walk at the front and then he'll behave. That's not impressive. Every kid in your class can tell you that. And yet it's that same level of processing, thinking, problem solving that they would use to then attack text and navigate text with the best decision-making power. And you had asked about Mom E, and it's the same concept. You know, kindergarten teachers will work forever, and first grade teachers as well, teaching short and long vowel sounds. But they never, or often don't, think about the trigger kids need to know which way to go with a word. So it doesn't really help me to know that a vowel can make two sounds if I don't have a clue which one to try first. That's like a wild reading goose chase. So, you know, that's really and it's not until second grade. I actually was speaking with a fourth grade teacher who was really trying to drill into our kids the vowel, consonant, vowel, open syllable, closed syllable, you know, like the word butter, divide between the two T's, then you have what's called a closed syllable. That's why the butter is butter. It's not buter, because if you spelled it B-U-T-E-R, you'd have a vowel, consonant, vowel pattern, and that would be an open syllable, thus causing the U to be long. She's like, my kids just don't get it. It's like, who would?
Exactly. You know,
that's just such a, that is the definition of, it's a trick, quote unquote, to help kids know whether a vowel's long or short. But the only kids who followed that trick are kids who already knew, because they already read the word enough to just know. The kids who actually needed a trick have no idea what you're talking about, because it's such an you're using all these abstract terms. And to think that you would use those with kindergartners would be ridiculous. And that's why it's slated as a second grade skill. But let's say they knew that if you see an E at the end of a word or one letter away from another vowel, that's Mommy E. And she will tell that vowel, you say your name, and by darn it, if they don't, she's only one letter away. She can reach over that head of that letter and make sure they do what they should. Now, if Mommy's not there, she's two letters away, she can yell and scream all she wants, but at the end of the day, her little arms aren't long enough to reach over two whole letters to get a hold of you and make you do what you should. And that's why in the word butter, the word is butter and not buter, which is what it would be if Mommy were one letter away from that U. So that makes sense. Now, having said that, what about when it's not an E? You know, it's not always an E. Vowel, consonant, vowel is any vowel. This is where the fourth graders were struggling. Words like motor, motorcycle, or hibernate. You know, what happens when a kid is working their way through an unfamiliar word and they will recognize it, let's say, as part of their vocabulary, but only if they can sound it out, because it's really long and can be potentially an intimidating looking word to a low-level reader. Having the Mommy E idea, and that just taps into what kids do already. Kids know if Mom's there, I have to do what I'm told. If she's here, but she's too far away to get a hold of me, I got some lag time. And if she's not here at all bets are off. Kids also know that sometimes Mom's got to get out of the house. And when she does, she'll put a babysitter in charge. So boys and girls, if you see any vowel that's one letter away from another vowel, it's the babysitter. It's going to do exactly what Mom would if she were there. It's going to tell that vowel, you say your name, and darn it, it will. So that helps kids, even in kindergarten. And there's actually a blog post where a teacher captured this little guy doing this, and he was the one in her class she was most worried about. He was an ELL kid. He came in, he didn't know any letters, any sounds. She actually videotaped the whole thing. She thought he was going to do a picture walk, and he started reading the book. But what was neat is she captured him talking about, because she was asking him, how did you know that word was hibernate? And he was going, because I babysit a vow. Because there's mommy eat, so I know that's going to say. So he was looking ahead to see, just like road signs. He could tell what he needed to do by looking ahead to see if mommy's there. Just like a kid, if I'm going to smack my sister, first I'm going to do something else. I'm going to see if mom's looking. Then I'm going to smack my sister. I'm no dummy. I'm not going to smack my sister or my classmate until I first look up and make sure the teacher's not looking. So these aren't hard concepts for kids if it's part of the world that makes them tick. Even though from an academic perspective, these are very difficult concepts. And yet they're the driving force behind reading. You can't read if you don't know which sound to make for vowels. Vowels are the heartbeat of every word. There is no word without a vowel. And to give kids, I've seen kids in, there was a district I worked in and they said, we don't teach the short vowel sounds until second grade. And I'm like, what? Huh? They said, well, research shows that the short vowel sounds are the most difficult for early learners to make and that they may not be ready to acquire them until second grade because of their auditory, their difficulty in auditory discrimination, which is true. Some kids don't, you know, catch those differences or their articulation's weaker and their ability to discern between the sounds. But you can't read or write anything without the vowels. So just from, you know, from the neat part with the secret stories is the vowels have a social or emotional trigger to land kids in the sound. So they're not going over the obstacles of auditory discrimination or articulation. Like they're not trying to make a schwa sound when they make the short U sound. They're just, see, you didn't know this, but, you know, I told you the vowels are superheroes. Well, they all have to be in disguise when they're not doing superhero stuff. So they have these little short and lazy disguises. And like U likes to pretend, he'll sit in the back of the class and pretend he's not listening. And every time the teacher calls on him, he'll go, and that's a short and lazy sound. So they all have these little social emotive triggers that kids just land in the sound because they're not trying to make a vowel sound. They're just the little old lady who can't hear, or they don't know the answer, You know, there are these reasons that these sounds will emerge, but it's not because of lip position, tongue position, practice points. Now, being able to give those vowels from the get-go in pre-K is awesome, but having a trigger to know which one most likely to try first is the second piece of the puzzle. And that's what I meant about knowing why you're doing what you're doing. If you're killing yourself in kinder or first to teach all these vowel sounds, short and long, but you never get to the point where you can tell them how to know which sound to try first, then why are you teaching the vowel sounds? The real reason you're teaching the vowel sounds isn't so kids can go, I know my vowel sounds. It's so they can read, so they can write. But the second piece to that is, okay, so which one do I try first? If I'm going to read a word, especially a multisyllabic word, I got to know what sound is the best bet for each vowel I come across. If I don't have that trigger, then I'm just going to be playing a math game with how many ways can I sound out this word, you know, and that's not the goal of the game. And I think that's where the book sometimes overtakes the teacher's common sense, because all the book says is you're going to work on the short U sound today. You're going to work on the short E. Why? Where are we headed with that? What's the next place? Where does that go? And if you ask yourself that question, you realize they need that second grade skill. I only teach kinder, but they need that second grade skill, because we're going to see words where, like, we're going to, and there were some words I'm trying to think, there's just so many, but they're, you know, over, you know, like I said, every word we use, every word we see, the word how, you know, that would be ha'awa. She would be sahi. The would be taha'i. You know, you can't read or write anything if you don't know what happens with when letters come together. It doesn't matter whether they're a first grade skill or a second grade skill. Common sense dictates that you got to know it, what happens when letters come together. They never make the sounds that they do when they're up on an alphabet train. They're like kids. They behave beautifully when they're separated. But in real words, they're not separated. They're together. So your alternative becomes memorization, and that's where we go off.
Right. I got to say this, because what you make me think about is this also explains, even to another extent, the impact of being in a family that talks with their kids and spends time with them singing songs from TV shows or whatever, and includes them in their conversations. So they're hearing words as opposed to when they're not getting that type of exposure at home where they get it duplicated. I can see where, you know, because it's going to make it even more difficult as they sit there and go, well, I've not heard these words, and they exactly make the wrong choice.
And I try to focus more on, because obviously, you know, everything is just, you can only go up from here. So So I always look at the lowest common denominator in terms of, you know, impact on a kid who basically is in a box. You know, some kids come to kinder and it's like someone literally took them out of a box, put them on a bus and sent them to school. They don't know who they are, where they are, what they're doing. Nobody's talking to them. They're talked at maybe, but they don't even understand that when a teacher poses a question, that a response, even if it's I don't know or a shoulder shrug, should they just, they're not used to being engaged in conversation. So everything that I focus on is targeting kids like that. Now, the beauty of teaching with the brain in mind is it is like a pull with a current that pushes behind the swimmers, which means everybody does that. You lift the whole bell curve. Those kids who have those opportunities, like what you're discussing, where they're engaged in this rich dialogue and they're actually, you know, they're working their way through conversations and thinking as they go. You know, the advantage those kids have is obviously, you know, there. But the focus that I like to take, because I hear teachers so often attribute it to why they're struggling, you know, are the kids who don't have any of that. And how am I supposed to teach if I've got parents who won't, you know, support me, if I've got kids who, you know, are lazy, won't do the work. I had one teacher tell me a couple weeks ago, she said, my whole class is lazy. She said, they're not learning anything. They're just all lazy. And I said, oh, you mean you have like a couple of kids that just won't kind of kick in? She's like, no, I mean my entire class, they're all lazy. Now, first of all, that's not possible. It's just not possible. Something else is the problem there. You can't have an entire class of kids that are lazy, but you know. But at the end of the day, you're going to have kids who are going to have none of the support pieces that make our job easy. So if you have a pool where that current's going to push everybody forward, then everybody wins. Your strong swimmers maybe look bionic, but your weak swimmers can dead man float and still get across the way.
Nice.
And that's, you know, that's really, I never even kind of factor in the kids that are from the environments that you're talking about, because those, you know, those are the kids that, you know, some kids just figure out a way. They get enough practice, they can connect dots even if they have to skip some steps. Parental involvement certainly is a tremendous help in that. But those are not the kids, you know, that I'm focusing my work to, even though those kids benefit tremendously from making things make sense because they get access to everything right from the start, which is what they want. That's what keeps them not being bored or not being, you know, lazy, as someone might put it.
Right.
You know, they have more to chew on. They can start taking off and running, you know. And I use this example as well. If I have a pet mouse and it's journal time and it's, let's say, first grade and OUOW is on the second grade scope and sequence of introduction, I want to write about my mouse. And I can scan that alphabet train all day long. I am never going to find the letter that says owl because it's not up there. Which really stinks, because now I'm going to divert and probably write about a darn dog, because I know I can spell the words that go with dog. But you know what? I don't have a dog, so I don't really care about the dumb dog. I'm going to write four sentences and then go to centers. I want to write about my mouse, but by the time I get that, my mouse could be dead. I mean, I might not get that particular sound until next year. And, you know, that's not what anchors a kid to reading and writing. What anchors them to text is reading what they are interested in, you know, writing a story they really want to tell. And to do that, they need open access to the whole code. Not just the bits and pieces we divvy out with some sight words, you know, kind of hard baked in between. And so that, you know, so for that reason, I guess, I love that, you know, some kids can take and run and have this rich, holistic opportunity to engage with, you know, beyond the classroom. But so many of our kids just don't have any of that. They have none of it. And the spark has to come from inside of them. And I find that competency comes from confidence. You know, when you can actually, or the other way around, I'm sorry. When you're competent, when you have the ability to do certain things, you're more engaged and likely to do them. And then you don't need a parent to get you a book. You know, you got your own pencil. You can sit down and write your own story. You know, you can pick up a magazine and actually make your way through it without having to ask mom, who maybe doesn't speak English, what's this word? You know, so that competency builds that confidence, and that cycle can happen without the parents maybe needing to be a part of the equation, you know, without the language maybe being, you know, intact for that learner.
That's so awesome and powerful, because, and what it comes back down to, all of what you're talking about with a classroom teacher, is the more you understand the why, the more powerful you become in what you do in the classroom and the time you take and spend, I would think.
Yeah, it activates your teaching superpowers.
Yeah.
When you know why you're doing what you're doing, it activates and intensifies all the things that you already know how to do. You can just start shaping them to streamline your path.
That's just so awesome, and fits really well with all the superhero movies coming out right now. They could do your voice thing and say, "And now
right.
I have the power of of the sneaky vowel," and you know, whatever.
That's right. Unfortunately, the power is just say your name, which doesn't impress kids too much. They would rather see them breathe underwater or like fly. But I have to always explain, you're not really looking at this the right way. If you were a K who woke up every day of your life and all you ever got to say was kuh, 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 then it would be like the best thing since sliced bread to be able to actually make another sound, let alone it be your very own name. So I do have to sometimes convince them that that is a great superpower, because by comparison, they're not thinking that's like, they're kind of thinking the vowels got shafted a little bit with that being their superpower, but give funny. It again right now.
That's awesome. Well, let's shift gears. And, you have quite a bit of electronic resource material for teachers, specifically a blog and a vlog. Can you share a little bit about them, and especially that YouTube channel? Cause you got some things happening there.
Sure. I do try and make sure that I feel like a lot of what teachers can do, my whole focus always is making something easy and making it apply to as much as possible. So it's always bang for the buck. There's so many things you're trying to do that we just don't have time to put all of our eggs in one basket and hone just one thing. You want something that can overlay everything and make it better, stronger, faster. And, knowing that not everybody's going to start out with secret stories, and I don't want you to have or buy secret stories in order to see the power that comes with teaching in this really 180 degree way to the way we normally teach and work with letters and sounds. So I tried to really make a concerted effort to put as much as I could online in downloadable free formats. There's an anchor pack that's free to download, a blog post goes through all the superhero vowels. Just all of these little tools and tricks that a teacher might need to just jump in tomorrow and toss something out in a different way. Maybe to kids she never even would have thought to toss that out to, because it's not on her scope and sequence. And then watch what comes back to you. And it's my hope that the motivation then to dig deeper, go further, and be more hungry be hungry for more will stem from what she sees as this 180 degree turn on the part of her kids. That's what I, and it's worked beautifully. That was my goal, is I thought, if everybody could kind of get a taste of how it feels to literally, and I like to call it breathe underwater, because I do kind of see, like, as teachers right now, we are told, okay, you need to spend at least 4 hours underwater every day. And to make this possible, you're going to have the scuba tank, you got to have this regulator, you got to have this mask, you got to make sure you bring this EpiPen in case one of the kids has an allergic reaction to the starfish, you got like all this crap. And how are you going to do what you need to do with the kids when you're overwhelmed with all this stuff and you're underwater, no less? So if you could breathe underwater, you don't need the scuba tank. The scuba tank makes perfect sense in the world where you can't breathe underwater. But if all bets are off and the rules start to change in terms of what you can do and when you can do it, you don't need to lug all this crap around with you. And so therefore, you can play a little bit more. So I like to give teachers a way to experience what it's like to breathe underwater so they can get a feel for what that world can be like compared to the one they're used to trudging through and kind of trying to overcome these inherent blockades in their path, what it's like to be in a place where those blockades aren't there, where the kid that wants to lick a shoe can. He doesn't have to stop licking his shoe in order to get what you're trying to feed him. He doesn't have to sit still in his chair for the 45th time because he still doesn't know this sight word. I find that when teachers have enough for them to experience what it's actually like, that taste is all they need to then want to run with it across the board. And that's usually when they do get the secret stories, at least for the reading piece of it. And then what they do from there and the things that I've seen them come up with in different directions. I mean, I've seen, high school history teachers take the concepts, and while they don't need it for literacy, perhaps, this was an AP history teacher that I'm thinking of, those concepts were applicable to things that he was already doing that were on the right path, but he was able to streamline it and tighten it up and understand why certain things work so well, and then build on those. So, just kind of getting teachers on that path. And of course, since my focus is literacy, I see literacy as the bridge to everything. I mean, it's a bridge that if you can't cross, you can't go anywhere. Doesn't matter how brilliant of a mathematician you are, if you can't read the word problem, or if you can't communicate, what you're doing and how to do it with text. If text isn't your friend, if you're not comfortable navigating through unfamiliar text, if you don't have the ability to make good decisions when you're working with text that you've never seen before, then you're going to be limited in your vocabulary development and your knowledge and your experience. So I focus on that specifically. And for me, it works out very well because I think there's nothing harder to teach than reading. I truly, and I say that as a person who's horrible in math. I don't know, maybe teaching me calculus would be equally awful to having to teach somebody reading, because I can't do math very well. But I just see reading as, because it's so nonsensical, and by reading, again, I mean the code, there's no meaning to be had, and the audience we're delivering it to are concrete thinkers, and it's all abstract content. So you've got every hurdle there is in your way as an early grade teacher. So that world, to be able to breathe underwater, it literally is as powerful as breathing underwater. Now your problem isn't how do I stay down for 4 hours to do this, it's, well, when do we have to come up? I want to stay down longer because look what else I can do down here, you know. And that's a huge shift for teachers. And I think the paradigm shift has to happen first. They have to shift their thinking on why we do what we do, and if we didn't have to do it this way, would we? And ideally, what would we do if we could, and why can't we, and does the brain science let us? And once they can kind of cross those hurdles, then everything just kind of falls into place, and then they can take those tools and run with them in their own way. But the vlogs, I think, are critical to really helping that shift happen. And then the downloadable tools are key to enacting those strategies. And the blog is more for troubleshooting. You know, it's really, I've made it more about teachers and by teachers, so that they can show what they're doing, how they're working, those light bulb moments, grabbing their kids, just giving bird's eye views of different types of classes, different types of students, and getting to see and other people take peeks in other people's classrooms. So between those three things, the vlog, the video, YouTube videos, the blog, and then the downloads, the free downloads that you can link to from both of those places. It really gives teachers everything they need to just hit the ground and start doing it. Just start changing the way they're putting things out there, and then watching the rewards just kind of roll right back in, which just further motivates the teacher to do more and go further and dig deeper.
Very cool. And I will put links to those resources in my show notes. So those of you listening, you'll be able to go back to the show notes and find links to her vlog and her blog. And you need to check them out, because there's lots of stuff there that you can make use of. And now I'm going to ask you a question that I know it's not fair, but if you wanted my listeners to take away one thing from our talk today and start doing, what would that be?
I think, especially for those that are focusing on literacy and focusing on reading instruction, to notice when you don't make sense. You know, take a minute to call yourself on the carpet and put yourself in the learner's shoes. If you've just said one thing that contradicts the next five things that you're going to say, if you're unreinforcing more than you're reinforcing skills that are going to be on your assessment, take note of that and then recognize that that is a brain's recipe for disaster. The brain, you are teaching to pattern making machines. The brains are, you know, our brain is a pattern making machine. We are looking for consistency and the ability to make a prediction that then pans out to be correct, actually releases dopamine, which then prompts the need to know more, to guess more, to stick with you, to engage, because I can actually make an internal mental bet on what's most likely, and my prediction is correct because my patterns are holding water. So if, and I think it's inevitable that you will be contradicting yourself constantly as a teacher of reading, notice when that happens and have a way to account for it. You know, think aloud. We talk about think alouds. We talk about, you know, putting yourself in the reader's shoes. And, you know, when you're doing shared writing, you know, talk alouds, think alouds, recognize and then work with and use as a jumping point or a catalyst, these opportunities to spotlight when things don't do what they should, the why behind it. You know, give them a reason to buy into your instruction and to engage with it, so that they're not just kind of left behind trying to make sense of something that has no logic to it. Ultimately, what happens when you aren't accounting for the things you say that don't make sense is the kids will tune out. If we're listening to someone tell us to do something, if it's our principal or our boss, if they never explain why we're doing it, and if we ever ask and we're told we just are, ultimately, you stop trying to analyze and think about better ways, or if I could, or what about this? What's the point? It just is. It just does. You just have to do it. So I think when the kids can't be critical analyzers or deep thinkers, when there's nothing for them to latch onto and connect with and then make deductions and work their way through, if you're not modeling that that's an opportunity, that that's there, then I think their brains are left in an off position for about 80% of the day. because you're working with text throughout the whole instructional day. You, if you're a K-2 teacher, you are weaving reading and writing experiences throughout the entire instructional day. And because your curriculum is only giving you access to the base bare minimum of the code, 3/4 of everything they see is making no sense whatsoever. So just notice that. Just be aware of that, especially when you pull out that letter sound assessment at the end of the 9 weeks and you're going to assess them on sounds the letters actually never say and that you have unreinforced for hours on a daily basis. And then you wonder why they don't know why it says yes. Maybe because it never does, ever, like maybe 3 words in our whole experience so far this year. Have you ever said that why a yellow, yes, you and yak. Other than that, I have no idea why I would say yeah. So just kind of noticing those things, just paying more attention and then paying attention to why you're doing what you're doing, asking yourself, why am I teaching this? And I mean, obviously, if it's your curriculum, you have to teach it. But why? What is the curriculum doesn't just give you hoops to jump through for no reason. There's always a method to the madness. So what is it? You know, don't just be caught up that you're on page 14 and it's Thursday. You know, a lot of things, I see a lot of things on something called Teacher Pay Teachers, which is a great resource for teachers. But some of it's geared toward making things easy for teachers, which although is a good thing, it can add to the idea that you can just print and go. And oftentimes I've even seen that as a selling point for some really hot units. Print and go. Print and go for 9 weeks. You don't even have to know what's going to come out. You just pull out the next page and go. If you were putting on a Broadway show, that might work because you can have act one, act two, and the finale, and it's going to look the same way every night twice on Tuesday. But this isn't a Broadway show, and your audience is what determines what act one consists of. And then act two may not even occur. You may spend the whole time on act one, or maybe you'll end up going to act three, and you weren't even supposed to put on act three until next year. So, you know, the assessment drives your instruction and not formal assessment, your daily interaction with kids. Resources, I look at resources as something you pull from. It's like a toolkit. I don't know what tool I'm going to need until the faucet leaks or until I have to hang a picture. And when I do, I want a toolkit to take and grab things from. But I don't want to be told you're going to use your hammer on Monday, your wrench on Tuesday, and you're going to need to use your screwdriver on Wednesday. How will I know that if I don't know what's going to break on Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday? So I think that's another big thing is just, you know, knowing that at the end of the day, you're in charge of where you go, why you're going there, and how to get there. And all these things, resources, curriculum, all of this, those are tools to get you where you need to go, but you have to know where you need to go. And you are okay. You know, I think new teachers especially can feel very, they lack confidence sometimes in not overriding the curriculum, but in just taking a bigger picture of where's this going? Where's this leading me to? It's not just about doing page 14 at 11:30 because my principal said if she walks in between 11 and 11:30, I'm supposed to be between pages 46 and 48. You know, why? What's happening on those pages that's going to lead me to wherever it is this is focusing? If you don't know that, then you are running around in 100 directions and going to get nowhere. You know, because even you don't know where you're going. The only people that know where you go in a print and go are the people who wrote the print and go. And they don't even maybe live in your same country. So they certainly don't know your kids. And so I think just to be, you know, weary of those things. And it really all just boils down to a quote that I'm going to share. I love this. Successful teachers place the why of what they do at the center, and they surround that by the what and the how. You know, the what and the how, that's your curriculum, those are your tools, those are your resources. But why you're using the what and the how, you know, why am I doing it? Where am I headed? What is the goal? That's the centerpiece of everything that you are building. And that's just I don't even know, that was not even attributed to anyone. But I think, you know, that's really the key. Keep the why at the center. And the only other thing I'll say, and this is I can actually attribute this particular quote. This is Joe Torgerson. Know your stuff, know who you're stuffing, and stuff every minute of every lesson.
Nice.
That's key too. We talk about assessment driving instruction and, you know, you teach to the learner, meet their individual needs. But, you know your stuff. As a teacher, know how does the brain learn best? What can I do that makes this make sense? Know who you're stuffing. Know your audience. You can't print go. You know, we go where? For what purpose? With who? You know who you're stuffing and stuff every minute of every lesson. Don't have me write in my journal about something that I have no skills. If all I have is a B, D, and a K, and I was just in a district, we were in the 9th week of school, and the district did not start formal instruction for kinder until the end of the 6th week because they wanted them to acclimate first. And when they did start them, they started them with a letter a week. And at this point, we were 10 weeks or so in, and they had a B, a D, and a K. And yet they were reading and writing across the day. Now, I don't know what you can read and write with a B, a D, and a K, but to me, You know, the more tools you bring to the table, the more value you take away. So if you're going to put these rich literacy experiences in place across the day, give them something to partake with those experiences, because then they'll walk away with a little more than they had. So again, stuff every minute of every lesson. Give them as much as they can have to partake more fully and get the most bang for the buck out of, you know, those time frames you're putting all this planning and energy into creating for them. So know your stuff, know your stuffing, and stuff every minute of every lesson. And Joe Torgerson said that, and I just think that sums up a great game plan
awesome.
For teachers.
Awesome, love it. So tell everyone a little bit about your book, Secret Stories, Cracking the Reading Code with the Brain in Mind, and where they can find it.
It's a book, posters, and CD. It's just kind of an all-inclusive piece that comes together. And like I said, it's not a program. It's a teacher set of tools to make sure teachers know their stuff. We aren't taught in college. I know I wasn't. I got a master's in reading and never once learned what to do when someone locked me in a room with a kid and made them teach him to read. Never. Had no idea how to teach Johnny to read. I knew 1,000 things about the way people felt about teaching Johnny to read. I could tell you every philosophy that existed under the sun, but I had no idea what to actually do with Johnny to help him read. Other than the alphabet, that's all we learned. So the Secret Stories compensates for everything teachers don't know about everything letters can do, because it's everything that kids need. It equips kids and teachers with everything that's in the box so they can think outside of it. Text demands that you think outside the box. And you can't do that if you don't know what's in it. So knowing what's in it is key, and that's really the goal of the Secret Stories. I mentioned some free resources that everybody can download, and they can access them probably the easiest from, I'm on Pinterest, I'm on Facebook, I'm on all those things, but I have a speaker website. It's www.katiegarner.com. And also the Secret Stories material is www.secretstories.com. From either of those two places, you will be able to link to my blog. And on the blog, you can also link to the blog. On both of those places, you'll see and be able to access all of the free downloadable resources. Most of them are housed on TPT, which is that Teachers Pay Teachers site, because it's an easy place to upload things that you can download free. The material itself, the Secret Stories kit, is what's available only in hard copy published format on the Secret Stories website. It's not in digital format. Only the free download pieces that's, again, housed on TPT. Whether you're looking, I think the more of the professional development aspect would be the speaker website I gave you. If you're looking specifically for the material, then that would be the Secret Stories website. But from both, you can access everything in between, which are those video blogs and blogs. And the Secret Stories, again, it's just a way to equip teachers and students with the thing they need to take, at least in the area of literacy, the brain research, and really run with it in a direction that opens up access to the whole code, no matter what grade level you are with. Fourth, fifth, kinder, there's no grade. The code doesn't change whether you're 5 or 50. You need the same stuff to be able to read and write. So there's no grade level version. The code isn't grade specific in a perfect world. It's accessible across the board. So the material would be the same, you know, it's applicable across any grade level where there are kids who have these holes.
Excellent. Thank you so much for sharing that. And if a listener would like to reach out to you, what would be the best way? Where should they start?
The best way to get me is probably the email link through the site. It's katie@katiegarner.com. You can also get me at katie@thesecretstories.com. And both of those links are on the respective sites. There's a contact Katie link on both of those two sites. I will say that one good place to start is I've just begun, because social media has got, I'm on different social media. And I do different things. I post different things, especially research links. I mentioned that Stanford sight word brain study by Bruce McCandless. That was so exciting to me to see. That just came out in 2016, I think. And there were so many different pathways to play. So I did a blog post about that. The first thing I did was post it on Twitter. I posted it on Twitter. And then I did a blog post that I think I posted on Facebook. And often I'll hear from teachers that follow me on one or the other that they miss something. Or there'll be a free download of something that I'm kind of trial and erroring that maybe is going to go into the published book, but I want to get teacher feedback. And I might only post that, let's say, on my blog. So I have been more disciplined about creating an access. It's not really a newsletter because I'm not good with it. I haven't sent anything for a month or so. But when I have things that I feel like teachers need to have, whether it's a research piece, whether it's a free download that I think they're going to want to take and play with, I will put it all together and it comes in an email. And you can access that at the bottom of any of either of those two websites, the speaker website, katiegarner.com, or secretstories.com. If you scroll down to the bottom of any of those web pages, you will see a little box that if you fill out, I try to use that as a dump for everything that's most pertinent across those social medias to make sure teachers have everything that kind of went over all of those venues. So that if they're not, you know, Twitter people or they're not, you know, Pinterest people, they don't miss something that I just think is really key in giving you direction and knowing where your, you know, your battles probably are. So just certain things that I think are just integral pieces that as a teacher in a classroom, I would want to either have, know, or use. Excellent. So that's probably the best place to start.
Okay. And I will put links all throughout the show notes for getting in touch with you, as well as those email addresses. So those email addresses, there we go. Too many S's there. So last two questions. One is, if you are given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers and they haven't started teaching yet, what advice would you give them?
You know, I'm going to go back and say, well, two different pieces of advice depending on new teachers and old teachers, because new teachers, I think, often have a leg up on old teachers because they don't know what they don't know. And so they have they're exuberant in their enthusiasm. I think new teachers sometimes, because the brain science shifts your paradigm in literally 180 degree direction, I think teachers who have taught for a long time become accustomed to skirting around the elephant in the room, not making sense, not expecting to make sense. It's just par for the course of what we have to do. This is the part we get to teach. It doesn't seem to correlate with anything they're actually doing, but it's the, you know, it's the nature of the beast. New teachers are more inquisitive about, how am I supposed to do that? This doesn't even make sense. Where does it say in this book how to teach Johnny to read? I mean, they're actually trying to solve what they see as these real world problems. So I think they have a leg up. Now, having said that, I would go back on their end and say that know your stuff, know who you're stuffing and stuff every minute of every lesson, because I think those are just words to live by as a teacher. You do have to know your stuff. You know, you have to know, the more you know, the more ways you can make it make sense to kids. So having a way, you know, to twist, to turn, to flip, to flop things is what makes you a good teacher. And you can't do that with content that you're just finally reading that's on page 14 that you hadn't laid eyes on before. Knowing who you're stuffing is key too. You know, you can't just rely on that page 14. You can't rely on the print and go. You have to let your assessment drive your instruction. So you have to have valid forms of assessment, even completely informal assessment. It could just be the engagement, the dialogue that you have with the kids or your group work. But you have to know why. That's part of knowing why you're doing what you're doing, is knowing who you're doing it with and why you're choosing that child to do it with and why you're choosing that material to use to do it with that child. Being able to answer those questions. So when an administrator comes in and says, well, what are you doing with this group? Oh, okay. Well, what are you using to do it with? Well, why did you pick that to do that with? I mean, I went into one classroom and I remember, I'll never forget, she had leveled readers, and the book, the group that was coming to read had a, they were all different levels, which is fine, except some couldn't read at all. Some could read perfectly. And this was a guided group reading lesson, which is supposed to mean we're going to stretch everybody and move everybody. So you want a similar level. And then the book that she was giving them, they had memorized, they'd been practicing it. So I said, well, let's get a book they haven't seen, ignoring the fact that the group was so all over the map that it was going to be tricky. And she opened her cabinet, and on the books, there were stickers, and there were three levels of books, hard, very hard, and then the last sticker said very, very hard. And she plopped down the very hard group. And I thought, you know, those are the kind of things that can really throw off your game, I think, as a teacher. You know, you need to know why you're doing it with him, what you're doing with him. How did you pick that to go with this? How did you make those choices? So just backtracking how you got where you are. And again, I think that quote just makes you do that. And then stuffing every minute of every lesson. Have I gotten everything that I can bring to the table in this lesson that's going to maximize the time and the value of what we're doing right now at the table? If you always kind of keep those three things in mind, I really don't think you can go wrong, because they kind of hold you down to the anchor that makes good teaching in a real simple formula. As far as older teachers or teachers who have more experience, their big issue, and I'm going to use this. I have a good friend named Danny Brazel, and I love that he finds these great quotes that really encapsulate stuff that you want to say, but someone long before you did it in a much more succinct and often profound way. And this is, you've heard this a thousand times in different ways, but if you, and this is Mark Twain's quote, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. And I think, you know, that's what we tend to do in education, where it's a cycle. We just keep cycling through ways we've always done it, and we keep getting things we've always gotten, and then we keep going to the other thing that we used to do and then get what we've always gotten doing it that way. And we shift like a pendulum. But the pendulum needs to literally be pulled off of the, you know, off of the device or off of the clock or off of whatever it's on, and put in a place where a whole different world dictates where we can go and what we can do. And that's where the brain science opens up a door. So, you know, whether you're a new teacher, whether you're an old teacher, just kind of recalibrating your thinking on what you're doing, why you're doing it, and what are some ways we can get there that are just there for the taking. And I'll kind of wrap that up with Kurt Fischer, who is, I had the privilege of speaking with him and with both he and Guinevere Eden. He was Harvard, Dean of Harvard's Learning in the Brain grad department, master studies. And Guinevere Eden is at Georgetown, and she studied neuroscience at Oxford, and they are brilliant. And we were on a panel together for the Learning in the Brain conference. And one thing that he said, and it struck me, and I made a note at the table actually as well, when I was sitting there, and I've since seen it in some of his published work, but he said, neuroscience speaks loud and clear to educators, but, you know, it's up to us to heed the message. You know, it's there, it's right there, and it's as clear as day, and it's not like the philosophies we were exposed to in college that can leave you scratching your head and more confused than when you started with whole language and phonics and, you know, even balanced literacy. Balanced literacy is ideal when it's targeted properly. It's patterns in context, just the brain learns best, patterns on a need-to-know basis. But all of that can be vague and ambiguous and nebulous, and the brain research really isn't. It's very cut and dry, and it does. It speaks loud and clear to educators, but we have to actually hear its message. And that, you know, it's not hard. You just listen. It's there, and it's just this gold for the taking if you just take advantage of just playing with a new way of thinking. You know, and again, for new teachers, that's easy because they don't have any way of thinking. So it's always easy to jump in with something if you don't have any other tools yet anyway. I think it's an equally daunting task for teachers who have been in the game a while, because it really is a diversion from everything that they've thought they've known in this world where we couldn't breathe underwater. I mean, now we can breathe underwater. So stop trying to figure out how to hold your scuba tank better or doing your, you know, workout exercises to lift your tank faster. You don't need the tank. You know, take advantage of that. Play with it. See how that feels.
Awesome advice. Awesome advice. Thank you very much. And so the last question I have is, do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? And if given a chance to say thank you, who would it be and what would you say?
Well, I will tell you, there are a couple people that came to mind, or that come to mind when you ask that. And they're both principals. And one was my first and one was my almost last. One loved me and one didn't. So I shouldn't probably say the name of the one that didn't.
No problem. No problem.
But I will say that they were both mentors, you know, and again, I'm going to pull from Danny Brazel because this sums it up so well. But, you know, your most unhappy customers are your greatest source of learning, whether those unhappy customers are parents who are mad, kids who you have trouble teaching, a principal who doesn't like that you're a square peg and you're not fitting in the round hole as neatly as you should. You know, you learn more from having to either account for things that maybe you never thought of, it was common sense to you, and now you're on the carpet to have to explain why you did what you did and why you would do it again in a heartbeat. Or parents, you know, where they really made you think about things and where your holes are as a teacher, or kids who really just aren't learning something that you think you're teaching perfectly and they're not getting it. But those are those difficulties are what makes you better. That's what gives you the information. You know, necessity is the mother of invention. What makes you reinvent things that need to happen are when the things you're doing aren't seeming to cut the mustard with whoever or whatever it is that you're working with. So obviously the principal that I had first, she was wonderful. She knew I was a square peg in a round hole and she loved it. And she had that management style. Actually, her name was Ann Killitz, and she's still a friend today. And I'm thrilled. I mean, I'm honored to say she is, because I was a 21-year-old music teacher actually when she got me. And she just gave you not free rein, she set a wonderful environment in which you were aware of what your expectations were, but how you met them was you were free to do and bring your own magic into that equation. And by fostering that kind of an environment, I think it's what really helped me. I never knew what it was like to follow page 14. You know, I always knew that why was what drove me, because nobody, you know, she didn't ever presume to tell me how to get here or there. Now, maybe if I were struggling doing it, she might have given me more, you know, ways to figure it out. And I did struggle, and I went directly to certain teachers that I felt were doing it really well. And then I used that to foster my own, you know, ideas. But I loved that she supported our crazy creativity, because what she did was she brought out the superpowers that were dormant, maybe in teachers that didn't know they had them, and you discovered them along with her, and she somehow had that perfect magical balance between fostering everything that you had inside you that you didn't know you had, while contouring, supporting, and helping you grow in the direction that she knew from, you know, a global perspective. Principals have a different mindset and perspective. They have a different path that they're on, bringing the whole flock to a direction. But you never felt thwarted by that. And on the flip side, the principal that I feel like I learned an equal amount from, maybe even more than Anne, because again, Anne just brought out the best in me. The one that did not bring out the best in me brought out other things, which is me learning more about how, what my convictions and what I did and why I did it. And she forced me to have to go research some things. I had to, you know, this was before some of the brain science was maybe showing in black and white what was working, what wasn't working. So you might have been on to something, but you couldn't justify why until maybe an assessment came out. And once the assessment came out, at least you could use that to back up what you were doing. But I just, you know, I just remember it being kind of a treacherous path in the moment. And yet never learning more in the 2 years I had with that principal. I cannot say how often she crosses my thoughts, because so many times I find myself saying something that the root of it I said in her office to explain why, you know, I was doing this or wasn't doing that, and being put in that position to constantly, you know, I said, call yourself on the carpet. She calls you on the carpet all the time. So you better know why you're doing what you're doing, because she's darn well going to ask you. And you better have a darn good reason if it's not what you're supposed to be doing, or the direction, or the tools that you're supposed to be using. So I just learned an incredible amount from her. She was like John Houseman in that old TV show. I mean, it just, you know, she just really kept you on your toes. I don't know if she would feel as favorable looking back at me. I hope she would. I think we kind of came to a great place at the end where she finally said to me, I have to remember you're just like a music teacher, but with a classroom, because she thought music teachers were all kind of crazy. So she's like, I just have to remember you're just like this out of the box person, but like as a classroom teacher. And it worked. But I'm so grateful to both of them. And then, of course, every other parent and child that's made that path a little harder, you know, because that's just where everything, that's where your memories are that brought you to the places that you're most proud of now. You know, those things that you fixed or helped or made better that maybe you weren't so great at the beginning.
That's awesome. Katie, thank you so much for joining me today. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing and learning about Secret Stories and all your wonderful work. And I wish you the best in all you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I had such a great time. And I love that I got to share just so much. I'm so excited. Thank you so much.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends. Take care.